Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg, that's me, ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Graduation is a sweet occasion, but finding the perfect gift can be a bitter struggle. MMS.com has a solution. Personalized M&Ms. Just imagine the look on your grad's face when they receive a custom candy creation featuring their school's colors, name, and even their photo printed right on some M&Ms. It's a thoughtful way to celebrate their accomplishments and make the occasion even more special. Visit MMS.com to create your own personalized gifts and party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's MMS.com. Use code WONDERY to receive 15% off your next order. Hello, snack lovers. Curb your cravings with My Mochi ice cream. Imagine a scoop of rich, creamy, premium ice cream in your favorite flavor. Now imagine that scoop wrapped up in the sweetest, softest dough known to mankind. That's My Mochi ice cream. Sweet, chewy, cool, and creamy, all in one bite. It's quite possibly the most joyfully chill sensation you've ever had in your life. My Mochi ice cream comes in tons of fabulous flavors, like strawberry, mango, cookies and cream, and double chocolate. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned mochis that are about 80 calories each, and it's also gluten-free. You can find My Mochi at Target or visit MyMochi.com to find a grocery store near you. That's MyMochi.com. Discover the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream today.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great-tasting, high-quality organic dairy ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you can have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This is the Ion Travel Podcast with CBS News travel editor Peter Greenberg, presented by Clear. Enroll today at clearme.com/Peter and try Clear at the busiest airports nationwide.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here with another edition of the Ion Travel Podcast. If you ever wanted to know the true economic power and impact of travel and tourism, then consider this. It's the biggest industry in the world. It represents 1 out of every 10 jobs, and before the pandemic, 1 out of every 5 new jobs. The global average of GDP represented by travel and tourism is just under 11%. But in many countries, either driven by or dependent upon tourism, the GDP contribution can be as high as 70%. Such is the case in the Turks and Caicos. So when the pandemic hit, it was an existential threat, not just as a public health issue, but an economic one. So I sat down with the country's premier, Washington Misak, to talk about how the Turks and Caicos not only survived, but how they are now thriving. Arnie Weissman, editor-in-chief of Travel Weekly, reports on the global staff shortages in travel and how this is not a short-term problem. And on a lighter note, I'll talk with Dylan Thuris, the co-author and founder of one of my favorite books, Atlas Obscura, about his latest book, Gastro Obscura, perhaps the ultimate food guide. First up, the honorable premier of the Turks and Caicos, Washington Missick.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
I've been coming to the Turks and Caicos for nearly 40 years. When I first came here, not many roads. There was one really bad hotel, the Ramada Inn. My guest is laughing. I'll introduce you in a second. But it did have a casino. I do remember that. But I keep coming back because it is small, it is manageable, it's beautiful, and it's managed to survive, especially even during the pandemic, in ways that other countries are still struggling. And so towards that end, and by the way, my next guest knows all about that because he's the honorable premier of the Turks and Caicos, Washington Missick. Mr. Premier, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, the Turks and Caicos is one of about 14 British overseas territories. We've been to most of them, and including, by the way, St. Helena.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, talk about remote, right?
Oh, yeah. They used to say the sun never set on the British Empire, but I'm not sure that's true anymore.
Well, if you include St. Helena, then you might be in, because for those people who don't know, it's smack dab in the middle of absolutely nowhere in the South Atlantic. It's midway between Africa and South America, and it's where Napoleon was exiled.
That's right.
Most people think he was exiled in Elba. Well, he was, and then he escaped, and then he fought the British at the Battle of Waterloo, and he lost, and he's so angry at the British, they said, okay, now we're going to send you to the one place you can never escape, and they were right. Yeah. He got there in 1815, he died in 1821, but a great place to visit if you can get there. The good news about this British overseas territory is you can get here.
Yes, many, many gateways from the United States and other parts of the world will land you here within hours, so particularly from the northeastern coast of America, you can be here on the beach here in 3 hours.
Does being a British overseas territory mean anything these days?
It does. It does. You know, sometimes I describe it as a love-hate relationship, but a great example of what it means is the fact that we were one of the first countries in this part of the world to have received the vaccination, and that is part of the reason why we've done so well during this pandemic.
Well, let's talk about that, because when things started to go south in March of 2020, you were one of the first destinations that I know about to completely shut down and lock down.
Yes. I mean, this is a small destination, like you said. We still have limited facilities, health facilities, have a couple of good hospitals, medical services here are socialized, but tourism is our main earner.
What's the GDP on that?
The overall GDP of the Turks and Caicos previous to COVID was $1.25 billion.
But how much of that was travel and tourism?
Travel and tourism, when you add directly, is around 39%.
But by the way, the international average is about 10.
Yeah.
You're at 39.
Well, when you add all of the linkages to tourism, it's a lot more than that. It's probably closer to around 76%.
Whoa.
Turks and Caicos Islands is probably the most tourism-dependent destination after Macau.
In the world?
In the world. Very tourism-dependent.
So when you shut down, you know what you're getting into.
When we shut down, we know when we get in. That was why it was very important to shut down so we can open early.
And so how did you do that? Did you really have a plan, or were you flying by the seat of your pants? Because it's a learning opportunity here.
Well, to be honest with you, you asked about the relationship with the United Kingdom. We've had a lot of assistance from the UK, Public Health England, worked with us to make sure we had the necessary protocols in place early. But also we were very fortunate in that we had significant reserves, cash reserves, so that we can close the border and still support ourselves during that period of time.
Because if you take a look at trying to connect the dots, if people don't come, people don't eat. You can't put food on the table. When you can't put food on the table, if you look at this historically, governments get destabilized and collapse. So you had to make sure you were protecting your own people. Otherwise, they had nowhere to go.
No, the truth of the matter is sustainability is a big issue. And COVID-19 has highlighted that more than at any other time. So government now has to refocus its strategic attention towards sustainability in all its dimensions, including food security and food sovereignty, because everything is imported, from an egg to a steak to a lettuce head, a head of lettuce, everything.
And if it doesn't come in, you're
in trouble. If it doesn't come in, we're in trouble. Yes.
So how did you keep the supply chain going?
Well, the supply chain was not impacted, fortunately. The ships continue to come out of Florida to deliver important merchandise.
Your favorite item is a container, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
You want that 55-foot-long container showing up every day.
Absolutely. If it doesn't show up, I mean, to be honest with you, if we don't, those ships don't come, we can be completely out of supply within 2 weeks.
Wow.
You know.
So. And that's just for the people who live here, not for the visitors.
Well, for the people who live here and the visitors, because obviously the frequency of the ship and the quantity of merchandise that's coming in fluctuates with the level of people on the island at any one point in time. You know, we have on Providenciales approximately 30,000 residents and at 400,000+ visitors a year. So that gives you an idea of
sure.
what we're dealing with.
Well, let's talk about those numbers, because let's go back to like January and February of 2020. The buzzword that was on the table pre-pandemic was over-tourism. That was topic A in every discussion everybody had. You know, you had the models of Venice or Barcelona. Nobody wanted to become another Venice, right?
Yep.
What was your challenge back then, before the pandemic?
Well, the before the pandemic, our challenge is basically the same before and now. This is a small, delicate ecosystem. And because of a confluence of factors, including the fact that this is an overseas British territory, British common law, the rule of law, security, the fact that we're so close to our source market, the United States, the fact that there's no conversion problem with the currency because we use the U.S. currency.
The Queen is not on the currency.
No. And the proximity, the strategic proximity to the U.S. and all of these things converge to make the Turks and Caicos an extremely attractive destination for investment and for tourism. So we have the problem we have is opposite to the problem a lot of other places have. We literally have people pushing at the door. So our problem is really containment in the sense that we have to balance from a sort of a triple bottom line perspective, economic growth, sustainability of the economy, and social balance. That's really our issue. Our issue is not people interested in the destination. We want to make sure we keep it pristine, keep it high quality, high level, and keep the economy, I mean the environment pristine, and also crime-free, and all of those beautiful reasons why people come here.
Of course, a lot of that was potentially disrupted by the pandemic.
A lot of it was interrupted by the pandemic. Absolutely, a lot of it is interrupted by the pandemic. But, you know, we did what we had to do. We closed down. As I said, we had good reserve because Turks and Caicos is one of the few countries in this region or in the world that actually has a sovereign wealth fund. We had significant cash reserves. We have one of the best public finance management structures in the whole Caribbean.
Which speaks to your background, right, Mr. PwC?
Yes, speaks to my background. I'm proud to have been associated with some of those good decisions.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you did lock down, you just didn't lock down in a vacuum. You figured out what your vaccination protocols were going to be. You insisted on insurance. You had to come up with an insurance protocol, yep. Right? And what's interesting about the insurance protocol is, let me give you the subtext of so many travelers. You know, everybody talks about pent-up demand. I think that's a lie. The demand has always been there.
Yeah.
But people were saying, as much as I want to go and as desperate as I am to go, I don't want to get somewhere and get sick and not be able to come home.
Yeah.
And that stopped them from going in the first place.
Yeah. So the insurance allow us to be able to medevac people out if they came and got sick. And that happened on a few occasions. People had to be medevac back to the United States, which is the source of our tourism visitors.
And now with the insurance?
It's still in place. And in fact, what we're trying to do at the moment is improve the whole portal experience to make it almost like a pre-clearance experience, where if you're booking from a safe destination and you arrive in Turks and Caicos, you're sped through the airport. That system will probably be in place sometime between now and the end of March of this year.
Mr. Premier, it's one thing that you had the insurance policy in place. That protected you as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you said only a few cases where they had to be medevaced.
Yes. We had very few medevac cases.
But the idea, you know, the true definition of luxury travel is when you get to keep your options. So the idea that you could was enough to get people to come here in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, we were also one of the first destinations to have acquired one to be fully vaccinated to come to Turks and Caicos. We were quite elated to see that the U.S. did it a month or so later. But again, because we're so dependent on tourism, we don't want to have to shut the islands down again. So we want to play it safe. And that might have cost us some visitors, but I think on balance, it kept us safe and might have been an attraction to some other visitors.
Right. It didn't cost you the wrong visitors. It cost
no.
You, I mean, when you think, right?
No.
Let's go forward, because you mentioned sustainability. It's a word that still basically begs for a definition.
Absolutely.
Right? How has that definition changed in the wake of the pandemic?
Well, the definition has changed in the wake of the pandemic on a number of fronts. One, particularly as it relates to the sustainability of food sustainability, right? It means one of the government's strategic focus now has to be on how do we put in place a strategy to ensure for at least a minimum number of months, a food security system, investing in agriculture, mariculture, aquaculture, so that if the ships can't come, at least people could eat. It does two things. It makes sure that the local people can eat, but it also builds up an industry that creates linkages to our main tourism industry, so that if nothing else happens, we have a system where, you know, the egg you're eating now is an organic egg, or the leaf of lettuce or the tomatoes in your breakfast could supplement the import that we would normally have to do. So it changed in sustainability in that way.
You're banking the food too.
Yes, yes, we are basically investing heavily in that area, and also from a sustainability point of view. Looking at how we can diversify the our economy. We've always...
What does the Turks and Caicos produce?
Well, actually, we've always had a small fisheries industry, and we've been on the cutting edge of the financial services sector, but we've never really taken off like in the same way the Cayman Islands or the Bahamas or the BVI have. But we do have, because of our strategic geographic location, there is the possibility for quite a lucrative fisheries industry, which I'm currently now exploring with assistance from the United Kingdom government as one way of diversifying the economy. Potentially, we could generate up to $50 million very quickly if we exploit properly and sustainably the fisheries potential that's here.
Especially if you protect the fisheries.
Well, this is why I say it has to be sustainable in terms of how the methodology of the catch and how it is processed and where it is processed and how it is financed.
I bet that was a learning curve for you, because what did you know about fishing?
Well, I grew up, I knew a little bit, because I grew up in North Caicos.
You fished.
Yes, I fished, but in terms of the economics of it,
yeah.
All I knew, you caught fish and you sold it and you got some money. That's all I knew.
And now?
And now it's a whole new, the world has changed, and of course, the ocean, and not only the ocean, but also the farming aspect of fishes is a huge, huge, huge sector, and is one that we intend to exploit.
Speaking of the oceans, Turks and Caicos, not necessarily a cruise ship destination.
Well, yes, in Grand Turk.
In Grand Turk, but not on this island.
No. I think we want to be very, very careful about how we segment our industry. We don't want necessarily, I think governments, mine and previous government, have always want to keep Providenciales free of cruise tourism. We do have some extremely high-end property here, and we do have a very so many options. I don't think we really need the cruise options. Grand Turk is a different situation altogether.
But you still have to manage it.
We have to manage it. In fact, we've just inked a $25 million expansion to the port in Grand Turk 2 days ago with Carnival. Before 2019, we were delivering 1.1 million visitors, Carnival's third most popular port in the world.
Of course, if you have a requirement that you have to be vaccinated before you come to the Turks and Caicos, that applies to the cruise ships as well.
Yes, and they've guaranteed us they are due to be here on the 7th of December with the first ship in Grand Turk, and they've guaranteed us that accept persons with medical exemptions, which has to be approved by our own medical system. All of their passengers will be vaccinated.
Premier Washington Misick, thank you so much for joining us. My thanks to Premier Misick. The world may be opening up to travel, but that doesn't mean it's prepared to truly greet you with the hospitality so many of us have come to expect. The editor-in-chief of Travel Weekly, Arnie Weissman, has some sobering numbers. Joining me now, actually in person, someone we have on the show regularly, not just on this show, but on our weekly PBS travel series called The Travel Detective, the editor-in-chief of Travel Weekly, Arnie Weissman. Arnie, welcome. You've come to the Turks and Caicos before.
I have.
Lots of changes here, but especially in terms of the pandemic, this is a country that moved quickly to lockdown. They literally shut down. I mean, people were basically kept in their homes. They couldn't even go out. They had military patrolling the street until they can get a handle on basically the protocols they needed to follow. And then they were one of the first to reopen with an insurance policy mandate in place, with testing in place, and they seem to have done okay.
Yeah, and what's interesting is this is a country, not really a country, a territory, as you mentioned, who is so dependent on tourism. The economy is, someone told me, I don't know if this is quite accurate, but 90% of the revenue that comes in is, and the GDP, is related to tourism. I was here last, maybe 18 years ago. The change is unbelievable. The entire coastline now is beachfront properties, many of them hotels, some of them private. But everybody who's coming here is related to tourism. There are 33,000 people who live here, and only 12,000 of the people who are coming are tourists. So you've got about a one out of every four people you're going to see here is a tourist, and the other three depend on them for a living.
Although there's still enough space so that you're not crowded, we're coming to you from the Beach Enclave, which is a set of villas on the water. All very private, all very exclusive, but you're seeing that throughout the island.
Yeah, when we've been going around, the roads are certainly not crowded. The restaurants are not crowded, but the good ones are full. And it does seem that things are relatively normal. We're in kind of low season, so that you would not be see as many as you might, let's say, next February. But I would think next February they are ready.
And they are. By the way, this is not a destination for cruise ships.
No, there's too many reefs around the islands. The water's not quite deep enough for a large ship to come in. They could tender in, I suppose, but they're just not interested in it.
It's not a bad idea. At least for this particular island, it seems to work.
Very much so.
You mentioned the depth of the water. From where we are right here in the beach enclave, if you just walk out into the water, you can walk for about a half a mile, and it never gets higher than your waist.
Right. I mean, it does depend on which island and which side of the island. What is really big here is kite surfing. And one reason is that the trade winds are pretty consistent year-round. And that isn't true on every island. So you will look out the window and see some kite surfing going on, which is fun to watch, actually.
So when you look at all of these island nations or overseas territories, so dependent, their economy not just driven, but dependent on travel and tourism, what's their biggest challenge moving forward in the wake of COVID-19?
Well, it's interesting because they have a lot of the people who are the workers here are actually from other Caribbean islands. And I think their challenge is not dissimilar to what you find in other places, which is staffing. So if you're in a luxury property, such as Beach Enclave, then they will do what it takes. I don't know if you've met all the butlers, but there's ones from Indonesia. There's one from Bhutan, one from Dominica. So it's really interesting that they're in a position to be able to bring staff in and keep them happy. But on the other hand, I would think that some of the larger properties that are dependent on very local, very regional help and are paying at that scale are going to have difficulties. What's going to happen, I think, here, what's going to happen in other places is they're going to have to raise the salaries in order to attract
people. But
that's
industry-wide now. That's industry-wide.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, we're redefining the minimum wage, whether you're a busser at a restaurant, whether you're a housekeeper, whether you're a bellhop. I mean, you know, it's the most interesting development to me, and some of the most problematic developments has been, if you go to a restaurant in Italy, the waiter who's at your table or the waitress who's at your table, it's not their job, it's their profession. It's what they have always wanted to do. It's what they aspire to do. It's what they do. It's what they love to do. That's not the case in many cases in the United States, where you have someone who's your waitress at a restaurant in Los Angeles. It sounds stereotypical, but it's not far from the actual reality. It may be an out-of-work actress. And during the pandemic, during these last 19 months, it's given everybody, I mean, everybody listening to the show, if you're honest, you'll agree with me, an opportunity to reassess your own life, your lifestyle, where you live, your cost of living, what's valuable to you, what's not. And we've seen unbelievable changes in mobility and movement in the workforce, where people are leaving certain cities and abandoning them, or they're now arriving in certain cities that were always ignored, and then, of course, questioning their lot in life. So it's more than just the minimum wage, isn't it?
It is, and there's actually this phrase, the Great Resignation. And there's actually more, if you, in polling historically, 40% of the people always say, yeah, I'm thinking about changing a job. But now, it's gone up to, in some cases, some polls are showing 70-80% of people are thinking it's time to move on to another job. And when you look also to your point of going to other countries and seeing people who take not a job but a career, one thing that's always impressed me is the taxi drivers in Germany. The people, when you have a conversation with them, some of them are college educated, they're all taking their job very, very seriously. And it's just, we have a different type of economy in the U.S., and a lot of times those jobs are just stepping stones to something else. They're just waiting to do something else.
So here's the problem. Right now, there are a lot of discarded stepping stones. There are a lot of things left on the wayside, if you will, and there's not a plan for replacing them. And so when we see staffing shortages at hotels and at restaurants, especially in those two sectors, the prognosis for filling those jobs over the next 6 months is not necessarily rosy.
No, and frankly, it may be much longer than 6 months. There really is, I mean, this we have depended on supply and demand, and for filling jobs, for all sorts of things. What's so interesting and what's so different is that there is a plenty of demand, and the supply, when it comes to labor force, has just seemed to evaporate. And it's sort of inexplicable, isn't it? Because the benefits have gone away. The pandemic benefits have gone away. People need to work. People need to eat. And yet those jobs are going unfilled.
And so what's the upside here? What where do you see this going?
Yeah, well, the upside is that I think wages will raise, which is a good thing for these particular jobs. But that the other side of that is it's going to add to inflation.
So the cost of travel and the cost of all goods and services are it's inevitably going to rise.
Correct. I think so. And so, you know, it's one of those things. Are we going to say, well, we're so afraid of inflation that people who have for years been, in essence, underpaid should continue to be underpaid? I mean, that's not a fair and equitable way to look at things either. So this is a problem society is facing. I don't know that there's an easy answer.
Well, you know, let's get down to the basic connecting of the dots. You know, your $8.95 cheeseburger just went to $11 at a restaurant. And I'm probably being low on that number. Simply because restaurants are going to have to pay more than the minimum wage to retain not just the people you see in the front of the house, but the people you don't see in the back of the house. And that doesn't even count the increased cost of the goods themselves, the actual food they're buying. All of that's going up.
Yeah, and we're facing, and it's not obviously just with the travel industry, but we're facing supply chain issues across the board. And that, too, is adding to the cost of everything. So at the same time, within travel and tourism, you're seeing a lot of countries who were having an over-tourism problem. They were having trouble. They were being overwhelmed, not just overcrowded, that they used this period to think, what can we do? And what a lot of them decided was we're going to go for a low-density, high-cost model. And that will, in fact, keep a lot of people away. The question is, does that work against the democratization of travel? Is travel only going to be for the elite to certain areas?
And by the way, the subject that Arnie just raised is going to be topic A for the next year to 2 years, because it's coming. Arnie, one of the things that I noticed as a sort of an interesting byproduct of the pandemic is if you thought travel agents were dead, if you thought they were extinct, think again. They were now needed more than ever as advocates for travelers to, you know, basically lobby to get people their refunds, their insurance, rebooking, things that just, that all the things that were disrupted during the pandemic, they now were in the middle of this fight. And they weren't making any money on it, but they were actually proving their value.
They were proving their value in that, and also as a result of the pandemic. If you're going to travel abroad now, you're going to spend quite a bit of time filling out what they call passenger locator record forms. You're going to be spending time, in the case of the Turks and Caicos, where we are right now, mandatory insurance. You have to have travel insurance and prove it to even arrive in the country. And by the way, this differs country by country by country, the different demands. So it gets very, very complicated, and reports in the New York Times, Town and Country Magazine, have all been saying travel agents, more than ever, are proving their worth in trying to get through the complexities. So what's happening, very interestingly, is it's creating changes in the travel agency models. So many of the people who are coming have not been to a travel agency since the dawn of Expedia. So they aren't accustomed to working with travel agents, and they're learning, as one travel agent put it, that a travel agency is not just Expedia with a face. It is, in fact, a whole model that you could look at real estate, a realtor, as being an example. Whereas I think a lot of people would think, okay, I'll talk to the travel agent, I'll get the advice, then I'll go shop online for the best price. So you wouldn't take a realtor's time and say, show me 100 houses and then just kind of go off on your own and buy. That's not really how it's done. So what travel agencies are doing increasingly is charging fees for their services, because the services are getting more and more complex. So then in a case like this, you would on a phone say, well, here's what I charge for this, here's what I charge for that. And you will quickly get the shoppers off your plate. because a new client for a travel agency, if they haven't been there for a while, requires a bit more hand-holding than in days past when they would have clients who
Well, right now, any client requires more hand-holding because it's so confusing out there.
Yeah. So what they're doing, it's interestingly, we've been reporting on travel agencies that are essentially firing clients who are not really adding anything to their bottom line because they are so busy doing so many things. They're kind of looking through who are the clients who really want the type of advice that they can give, because in the old days, they were really order takers. You couldn't buy an airline ticket other than going directly to the airline or through a travel agent. Now, of course, everyone can just go online and get an airline ticket. So these days, travel agents who now call themselves overwhelmingly travel advisors are doing exactly that. They're providing advice, they're providing detailed recommendations day by day, and they are proving their worth.
And by the way, you found out how much they were worth when everything went up in smoke after the pandemic, because who were you going to call? You know, the people who went on the online travel agencies found out very quickly there was nobody you could call. They didn't have the staff, they didn't have the resources, they weren't structured that way.
No, they were a call center, essentially. I mean, trained.
Assuming you could get somebody on the phone.
Well, that's just it. And where travel agents have in the past proven their value is, for instance, when the volcano went up in Iceland.
2010.
And the air traffic across the Atlantic was disrupted. You could wait on hold trying to talk to an online travel agency for hours to try to rebook. Or if you had a travel agent, you'd call your travel agent. They've got the reservation system right in front of them, and they were filling all the seats of what it was available in terms of routing around it. So that was one instance where there was value proven. And the other thing that people have seen is that very often maybe the price would be the same with a travel agent or an online agency, but the travel agent has arranged upgrades. And so if there's an issue, they can call the general manager. They add value.
There are travel agents, and many more of them than you'd think, that have preferred supplier relationships with hotels, airlines, and cruise lines, so that if you went online and the biggest myth is when you go online and you're looking for a fare or a hotel room and it says only three available or last two left, it makes you think that there are only last two left. No, it's the last two left in the allotment that particular online travel agency was given by the travel provider. It doesn't necessarily mean there are only two seats left on the plane.
Right.
I mean, and people forget that all the time, and they go, oh my God, I got to book it now. You know, we should never lose sight of the importance of the conversation. No different than what I'm having with Arnie right now. That's where the travel agencies really prove their worth. They can talk you through stuff.
They can. So the when you start listing all of these different values that are added by using a travel advisor, the fees that they charge are well worth it.
And by the way, I want to be clear on something. I'm not here promoting travel agents. I'm promoting and presenting the opportunity to have that conversation. So for example, I'm not telling you not to research online. I do it every day. But once you do that, before you commit to anything, talk to somebody. And once you do that, you have a halfway decent chance of winning the battle.
Yeah, because you'll be understanding all the options.
It's harder to focus than ever these days. Thankfully, C4 has reinvented the energy drink game with C4 Smart Energy, the only energy drink clinically proven to provide enhanced mental focus, containing 200 milligrams of natural caffeine, a blend of vitamins and zero sugar. It was formulated to support your well-being and help you feel your best, all while enhancing mental focus. From your brain to your body, C4 Smart Energy does it all. And tastes amazing. Look for Smart Energy in the beverage aisle at your local Kroger, Albertsons, and Safeway grocery stores. C4 Smart Energy. Stay focused.
My thanks to Arnie. When Dylan Thuris' first book came out, I not only bought a copy for me, I then bought about six copies for my friends. It was Atlas Obscura, which for travel geeks like me was the perfect bedside companion. Just open it every night to any random page and learn something fascinating about the world. Well, Dylan is now back with his approach to global food, Gastro Obscura, and the book is just as provocative and informative. If you were to ask me my favorite travel books over the last 2 or 3 years, number one would be the book that I not only bought for myself, I give it to gift as gifts to others, because it's one of those books, and I can tell you some other examples, but this is one of those books that you keep on your bedside table, and then every night you literally open it up to a random page. Just open it up to a random page and you learn something. Of course, that book was Atlas Obscura. Well, there's now a new one out. It's called Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide. And joining us now, the co-founder and creative director of Atlas Obscura, Dylan Thuris. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing, Peter?
Good. And I'm not kidding. I mean, I will keep that book and just, it's the most entertaining thing I do other than an atlas, a regular atlas. And I tell my own staff, I say, do you own an atlas? And most of them don't. And I say, get a small one. You don't have to get the big coffee table version. And then every night before you go to bed, just open it up to an obscure page. And guess what? You're going to learn something. And that's exactly what I did with your book. Because what your book really was, you know, the full title was The Explorer's Guide to the World's Hidden Wonders. And you found some pretty obscure things, which I think was great, because that's the whole point.
That's the idea. The idea is, and you're using the book, I think, in the way that both the first book and this book, Gastro Obscura, are sort of meant to be used, which is as a way to kind of just step into a little part of the world, learn a little bit about it, find out something fascinating, maybe, you know, something you'll bring up at a cocktail party and say, oh man, did you know about this incredible thing or this incredible food? And then I think, you know, it can also be used as a sort of reference when you are actually traveling to say, oh, maybe I want to do this thing, or maybe I want to try this dish.
Well, the whole idea is to be able to immerse yourself in the experience. But first of all, you have to know about the experience. And that's where your book comes in. The Atlas Obscura, the original book, still, I mean, I'm learning stuff. You had a couple things in there that I knew about. A lot of things in there, of course, I didn't. But in this book, if you're a foodie or think of food at all, you got to get this book, because it not only tells you about the actual food itself, it tells you about the process and how it got to be. And, you know, I've always said that if you can understand and appreciate the process, that's when you value the product. And so when you ask kids today, and by the way, this drives me nuts, when you ask kids today, you know, where food comes from, and they tell you the store, I got a problem with that. I think that's another reason why you did this book, to let people know you can actually, you know, go someplace in the world and have an amazing experience with food as long as you understand the process.
Yeah, I mean, we try to do a couple of things in this book. So this is, you know, if Atlas Obscura was all about showing you the hidden wonders of the world, these fascinating places that for various reasons don't make it into guidebooks or people just don't know about, we wanted to do the same thing with food, with Gastro Obscura, with stories of recipes, ingredients, restaurants. And so we try and do both, like, kind of the history and storytelling of the food, where it came from, why it exists, or how it's made. And then we also try and give everyone a how to try it. So here's a place where you might actually go and eat this, you know, stew that's been simmering for 45 years in this Thai restaurant in Bangkok, that kind of thing.
Not to mention the 2,000-year-old eggs in Egypt.
Yeah, well, the egg ovens. So the eggs themselves aren't 2,000 years old.
I know.
There is such a thing as a century egg, which is basically a long kind of fermented or marinated egg. They're actually quite good. They look disturbing because they're sort of black in the yolk, but they're delicious. But the egg ovens in Egypt were an example of, you know, basically chickens stop laying eggs when it gets cold. I've got 4 chickens, and in the winter you just don't get eggs, and that's how it is. But people figured out a really long time ago that if you can simulate the warmth for a chicken, if you can kind of create the right warm environment, chickens will continue to lay eggs. And so that is exactly what was happening in these egg ovens. They were a way of sort of controlling temperature and making the perfect environment for eggs to be laid and hatched. So that was that.
We're talking with Dylan Thuris, the co-author of Gastro Obscura, a food Adventurer's Guide. Dylan, in the research for this book, what was your biggest surprise? What is one of the discoveries you made that gave you an oh my God moment?
It's a really good, okay, so here's here's one I love. You're familiar with a turducken, right?
Oh yeah.
We're coming up on Thanksgiving. Turduckens got really popular, I think, because John Madden, like, brought one to the Super Bowl or something. Anyway, so you know, a turducken is a chicken inside a duck inside a turkey. But this is really small potatoes in the world of what's called engastration. So that's basically putting one animal inside of another. And this was a really popular thing in the medieval period. And it lasted for a while. So there are a couple of recipes for this that are just absolutely mind-blowing. So one, there's a kind of legendary recipe for a Bedouin stuffed camel. And it's basically fish stuffed with hard-boiled eggs, stuffed with rice, put into chickens, put into lambs, put into the body of a whole camel, and that is roasted over a spit. It's not totally clear that this has really been done, but there is definitely, it is talked about in kind of traditional Bedouin recipes. There's another one that's my favorite, which is the first, basically the first kind of restaurant critic in France wrote a cookbook in 1807. And he has a recipe in this cookbook called the Unparalleled Roast. And it starts with taking a single caper and putting it into an anchovy. And the anchovy is placed into an olive. And the olive is put into a warbler. And put into a series of 17 birds until you finally at the end get up to a turkey. But the turkey is then stuffed into what's called a bustard, which is like a kind of giant peacock-like bird. And then this is cooked for about 24 hours. And so this 17 bird unparalleled roast, it's like, what's funny is probably no one was making this, but it definitely got attention for this guy's cookbook and really worked to get people fascinated. People have been fascinated with this forever. So the unparalleled roast kind of raises eyebrows.
See, when you tell me that story, I think that when you finally get it together, you drop it out of a plane at 30,000 feet and destroy a city.
Exactly.
Unbelievable. What, now tell me about the Thailand Monkey Buffet Festival. That's a little scary.
You think it's scary?
Well, tell me more.
Well, okay. So basically the Thailand Monkey Buffet Festival is, it's not for humans. It's a festival held for the monkeys. And the idea is this giant tower of fruit is assembled and the monkeys are invited to feast. It's got an opening ceremony with dancers in monkey costumes. And then the real monkeys arrive and begin climbing this tower of fruit and basically going nuts. And it's a ton of fruit. It's like 2 tons of fruit. So monkeys are, you know, revered as a symbol of prosperity and well-being in Thailand. So this is part of that tradition. So basically feeding the monkeys is good luck.
Of course, there's a travel aspect to this book, of course. And, you know, I've been to the Atacama Desert in Chile, the driest desert in the world. Tell me about the beer. I mean, that's crazy stuff.
Sorry, say that again?
In the Atacama Desert in Chile, one of the driest, you know, places in the world. The beer. Yeah.
I didn't hear the word beer. That's what I thought you said, Badir. And I was like, oh. No, yeah, no, the beer. So, right. So this is a part of the world where there's basically no rainfall. So getting water is an enormous challenge. And in the 1950s, a solution was devised to gather water in this area. It's a really ingenious system. Basically, the only water that comes in is these big fog clouds roll up and over and into the desert off the ocean. And so that was really the main available source of water. So these nets are put up and they basically collect the dew. And the dew is then funneled down into pipes and then collected in these big cisterns. And once you got water, you're basically a few short steps from making beer. So in Chile, they make this fog-derived beer. Every beer you're drinking is brewed from the fog that surrounds you in that desert. So it's a really, like, I find it a very romantic idea for brewing. Yeah, I really like that one.
Yeah, yeah. Wine has a bouquet. The beer has a mist.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You know, people say that it's like very crisp and that they can taste a little bit of the salt because the fog is coming off the ocean. And they say there's a little bit of a kind of nice, tiny bit of that flavor in there.
We're talking to Dylan Thuris, the co-author of Gastro Obscura, a food adventurer's guide. I highly recommend it. So I'm doing my little research and reading the book, and I come across a fact that really surprised me, and I don't think anybody in my audience is going to get it. I didn't get it. You figured it out. The highest annual per capita pizza consumption in the world is who?
Well, what was your guess? If you had to guess, where would you guess?
I would have guessed the United States, or people would get Italy, of course, but no, it's none of the above. No,
it's Norway, and it's not like pizzerias. It's freezer pizza. Norwegians love frozen pizza. They have the grocery stores have an entire aisle dedicated to just frozen pizza. It's not ultimately clear why frozen pizza became so popular, but basically it is just the go-to food for, like, I don't know what to make for dinner. Let's get frozen pizza. And it's a little bit different, too. They use Jarlsberg cheese and paprika. And this sells 9 million pizzas every year. They are an absolute pizza-loving people.
But frozen pizza. Oh, my God.
But frozen. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Now, the next item up for bids in the book that I thought was hysterical is I spent a considerable amount of time in Guam, in Micronesia. And, of course, the number one popular food there is Spam. God help us. And then I find out that there's one country that really hated Spam more than I did, Korea.
So Spam is an interesting item. It's from, it was invented where I'm from in Minnesota. There's the Spam Museum in Austin, Minnesota. And the thing is Spam traveled the world with American GIs. Essentially everywhere American soldiers went, Spam followed. So you'll find that now Spam, do you have a guess of what state is the most fond of Spam, where Spam is the most popular?
Okay, I'm going to say something stupid. Minnesota.
It is not Minnesota. We put it in our church casseroles and things like that, but not that much of it. No, Hawaii. Hawaii is the Spam.
Of course, of course.
Because it came there with World War II. And then basically it just transformed into a million different dishes. So Spam musubi, which is almost like a Spam sushi, it's Spam wrapped in rice and seaweed, is incredibly popular. But they have the Spam jam, which 35,000 people show up every year. I would say at this point, Spam is effectively Hawaiian as a food. It is more interesting things happen with Spam in Hawaii than anywhere else. Except there is a dish, and I think this is what you were getting at, called Army Base Stew. That is,
there we go.
It's got a similar background. So this is a South Korean stew. And again, this is soldiers show up in South Korea for the Korean War in the 50s, and they bring all of this stuff with them. And there's, meanwhile, while these soldiers are showing up with all their provisions, there's a food shortage in Korea. So people are hungry for whatever they can get their hands on. And they begin bartering with the soldiers or scavenging what's sort of being thrown out. And what they find, what Koreans find is basically American cheese, beans, ham, hot dogs, and of course, Spam. And all of this gets added to more traditional ingredients like kimchi and chili paste and noodles. And it becomes this thing called army based stew or budajjigae. And what starts out as a very kind of low class dish over time has become really an absolutely beloved South Korean dish. You can find it in restaurants all over Korea and really all over anywhere there where there's a Korean diaspora, you can get a budajjigae. And so another example of the way that food, you know, food is the story of kind of two things crashing into each other. Sometimes people say fusion, but I think it's more like fission, because it's two things crashing into each other, and then a bunch of other stuff kind of shoots out of there and makes new dishes, new styles of cuisine. And budajjigae is a great example of that.
Oh, but how is Spam illegal in South Korea? Why?
Spam, as far as I remember, is not illegal in South Korea. I think it's part of the stew. I'm not remembering something, but it's definitely part of Korean food.
I gotcha. All right, so now I got to go to the next item of forbids here.
You're right. There was a ban on it for a while because after it became popular in the 50s, they I forgot about this whole part of the story. Basically, it became illegal. There was trading with soldiers. So it had this kind of black market quality to it. And then
black market Spam.
Yeah, it was black market Spam. I forgot about that. It was the 80s. And then they said, okay, And they produce their own version of Spam now. There's a Korean version of Spam. Sorry,
So now I've got a question for you. Where is the largest McDonald's in the world?
That is a good question. Let me see if I can remember. I'm thinking of there's the fake McDonald's in Iran. Is it in Paris? Is that the big McDonald's?
No, I'm going to surprise you.
Is it where we have a couple of really fancy restaurants? Is it Portugal? Where is it? I forget it.
No, it's not. I'll tell you where it is. It's in Guam.
Oh, really?
And the reason is they got sick and tired of eating Spam.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. Who knew, right? Who knew? We're talking to Dylan Thuris, of course, the co-founder and co-author of the Atlas Obscura books, the latest being Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide. Dylan Thuris, thank you so much for joining us. And again, the story that really amazes me is that every time I turn the page in this book, I'm wowed by stuff I didn't know. And it's more than just cocktail party conversation. It's actually stuff I retain. That's how stupid I am, but it's true. And
being surprised about the origins of pad thai.
Do
you feel differently about eating it now, knowing where it comes from?
Well, you know, it's one of my favorite dishes. I lived in Thailand for about 25 years. And now when I hear what the origin is, fill me in.
Yeah, so what's interesting about pad thai, I mean, it's funny because it's a dish that most people are pretty familiar with, but a lot of people don't know its backstory, which is that it was essentially called into existence by the dictator of Thailand in the 30s, Plek Phibon Songkram. He's a hard name to say, but he wanted to basically make a national state. He saw all these big colonial powers sort of encircling Thailand, and he thought, okay, if I'm going to compete, I need there to be a sort of official Thai state. And that's when the name changed from Siam to Thailand. He introduced sort of the official language, you know, introduced official clothing requirements, and it wasn't very friendly. I mean, a lot of this was oppressive to various ethnic and tribal groups. But one of the other things he did was he said, we're going to have a new national dish. It's going to be called Pad Thai, despite being made out of Chinese noodles. And it was something that, you know, he grew up eating. And so he just told everyone, you now need to serve Pad Thai. He set up food vendors all around the country. And the funny thing is it worked. Pad Thai is the national dish of Thailand. It is beloved. You know, Thai people will say, you know, if you want to know if a place is good or not, try their Pad Thai. And so in a weird way, it was actually effective. It did do what he wanted it to do. Yeah.
Speaking of other heads of state, if you go to Cuba and you order ice cream, it's pretty good. But the history of it will surprise you, correct?
Well, the thing, yeah, there's some very interesting things about Cuba and ice cream. Fidel Castro loved ice cream. He loved it. He loved it so much, in fact, that the CIA tried to kill him by putting poison into his chocolate milkshake. It didn't work, but it got really close. They were going to drop a pill into this thing, but the pill got like stuck in the freezer. But it's called the closest that the CIA ever got to assassinating Fidel Castro, which in a way, like, I mean, God, thank God it didn't happen, because who knows what would have happened. But yeah, the big thing is that Cuba is a huge place for ice cream because of Fidel Castro's love. And he was said to eat like 9 ice creams a day or something. He had like a huge ice cream love affair.
I know. I was down there in 1978 to interview him, and he was late because he went to get ice cream.
Is that true?
Yes.
That's incredible. Yeah, I mean, we have a specific ice cream parlor in the book that is like was his one of his favorite ice cream parlors. And
it's still there today.
It's still there today. It's got like 20 some flavors. Yeah. And Cuba still has a very strong ice cream connection because of Fidel Castro.
You know, the other thing that's interesting to me is, and I learn things all the time, honey doesn't decompose, right? It doesn't, honey just stays forever, but honey had a really interesting effect in terms of war, didn't it?
Oh yeah, there's a great there's some great honey related stories in this book, but I think the one you're talking about is one of my favorites. So in Turkey, near the Black Seas, near the mountains, there is a very specific type of rhododendron that grows there. And there's a ton of different types of rhododendrons in the world, but this type has something in it called the grayanotoxin, which is a neurotoxin. And, you know, in one rhododendron, there's hardly any. But as the bees collect all of the pollen from the rhododendrons and turn it into honey, it basically distills it into this psychoactive substance. And it's called Delibal or mad honey. And people have been using it there as a kind of a medicine for literally thousands of years. You put a little bit, like one tiny teaspoonful in your tea is enough. Don't do more than that. And it's said to help with diabetes, with hypertension, all of this kind of stuff. So it's got a long history as a medicine. But if you take too much, it starts to cause hallucinations, dizziness. People can die if they have enough of it. And if you go all the way back to 67 BC, what you find is a whole army of Roman soldiers invading this region of Turkey. There's a guy named King Mithridates who refused to submit to the Roman Empire. And they kept invading and they kept getting beat. And so this time they send a huge group of soldiers and they're sure they're going to win. But Emperor Pompey marched this huge group of Roman soldiers into this area of Turkey to defeat King Mithridates. But King Mithridates had this ingenious plan. He left out all of these chunks of honeycomb all along the Roman road. And of course, these Roman soldiers are starving and could not resist. They picked them up, they eat this honey, and very shortly after, they are absolutely tripping their butts off and they are fainting. And basically King Mithridates, by these soldiers, swoop in and wipe them out. It's one of the great sacks in Roman military history. And it's just an incredible connection.
I love it. The gift of honey that keeps on giving. Dylan Thuris, the co-author of Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide. Thanks so much for joining us. A great book. Again, remember what I told you guys, keep it on your bedside table, open it up to an obscure page. They're all obscura. Get it? And you're going to learn something. My thanks to Dylan, to Arnie Weissman, and to Premier Washington Missick of the Turks and Caicos. And my thanks to you for listening to this Eye on Travel podcast. For more conversations with the world's leaders in travel, as well as answers to your travel questions, be sure to rate and review this podcast wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. And for all the breaking travel news, that's an easy one. Just log on to petergreenberg.com.
Special thanks to our sponsors at Clear. Enroll in Clear at clearme.com/Peter and zip through busy airports nationwide.
Hey, Prime members, Peter Greenberg here. You can listen to Eye on Travel ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, and you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. And before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at Wondery.com.
The chilling new original docuseries on Paramount Plus.
Why did he kill his family? The answer lies across the ocean in a woman named Sylvie.
She's a CAN model.
Where desire leads to deception.
I ended up spending $12,000 and $15,000 a day.
It was addictive.
I can't get you out.
And obsession leads to murder.
Who did this to your family?
You can't really maintain a fantasy forever.
Control Alt Desire. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.